Off the Ball, GAA.
I think if everybody's been honest with themselves, we would have went down to Dublin on the hope that we can ignite the thing again. But once we were beaten by Cork, I think we knew deep down that we weren't going to win in All Ireland.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
And you're welcome to the Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball. It's John Duggan with you through today, and I hope you're enjoying the weekend, enjoying the weather, and delighted to have in studio the former Donegal Ladies Gaelic football skipper and Sunday Independent columnist Nadine Doherty, and Mick O'Keefe, the chief executive of Tenio Ireland, a global CEO advisory firm. Mick also once lined out for the Dublin senior footballers. Nadine and Mick, you're very welcome.
Just once.
To the show. Just the once, Mick.
Hanging off that coat.
The great man, if you turned around enough at Burn Cup matches, you'd have spotted me already.
One cap. Dubs in Galway today, and the World Cup is in full swing. Are we enjoying the greatest show on earth?
Yeah, like I suppose with work, being a teacher as well, not catching many games live, but picking up on the clips and the highlights. And I just think aesthetically, John, it's been class. Like the stadiums are unbelievable. It just looks so, so good. Highlights have been deadly. I mean, the quality across the board so far, so good. And it's all about the big guys, really, isn't it? You know, and coming into the World Cup as well, there was a worry with, you know, the geopolitics and everything that was going on, like, you know, what kind of competition it would be. But thankfully, the football is really taking centre stage, and it's really enjoyable. And it's just going to get better as the teams narrow down.
Yeah, it feels a bit like we're having the little canaps, you know. We haven't really got into the main course yet, you know. So it's been good, I think. I think now we're into the last 32. I think it's going to be brilliant. I agree with you. I think the colour, I think what, when you're looking at the World Cup, it's the teams, you know, the Uzbekistans and the Cape Verdes, and they're all that's the story of this round, I think, is the smaller teams and the Minnows and the Shocks and the Ecuadors and stuff. I think from now on in, it's going to get really, really good. Like the quality is there. Like you could talk to, you know, if you had like a punt, you look around, you say, well, it could be six or seven teams here I back that could win this, which is going to make it a brilliant tournament from the quarterfinals on. It's great colour. It's great spectacle. You know, I have young boys under the age of 12. So I'm collecting stickers, pretending they're collecting stickers. But, you know, that's kind of the best World Cup is the one you watch when you're 10 or 11. So I'm kind of seeing it through their eyes as well. I think it's been good. I think there's a lot of games. I think the times are kind of funny. Like there's certain teams I haven't seen because it's on it. Even though I'm half an insomniac, I'm not watching games at 1 and 2 in the morning. So, I think it's good, and I think it will be a cracker from here on in.
Are the kids following the players, or are they following teams?
They're following teams actually, and players. So look, they'll follow Mbappe and Messi and Haaland and that. But funny, England is the team they want to watch actually because they know all the players. Yeah, France. To a lesser extent, but yeah, it's kind of a mixture of both. But like the games where they kind of really sat down and watched, because all short attention spans at that age, is England, actually, funny enough.
Yeah, I find that with the kids in school, it's the English team. And then obviously they all watch Bayern Munich this year. So wherever the Bayern lads are, they're following those teams.
Is it primary or secondary? Or?
Primary, yeah.
And are most kids engaged in it?
The boys are all engaged.
Right.
Yeah. Few of the girls, the teachers have been great, you know, at bringing attention to it. But yeah, the older boys are all fully invested in it, you know. But I think as well, you know, with the three teams going through from each group, initially I just felt, oh, that's just going to take so much out of it. But I think what we might find with it, especially looking at Norway the other night, you know, resting the 10 players, I think we're going to have the best players fit for longer, because all of those teams, the majority of those teams have had the opportunity to rest guys. So I think that's going to be a huge positive further down the line in the competition. I know they still play an extra round, but in that regard, I think it's going to work well.
The kids love, you look back when you were young as well, and we did the same in a different way, but they love like pink boots. Who's wearing pink boots? Who's wearing yellow boots? Like this kind of stuff that I'm not really necessarily painted. Who's Adidas and Puma and Nike? Who's going to win the battle of the brands? Like they're watching this kind of stuff, and top goal scorer stats. Love stats.
Yeah, you know, they're mad for stats.
So yeah, so it's funny what they watch and what they don't watch. And the games are long. Like they're not watching every minute of every game, but they're dipping in and out. But then they're talking about stuff, and I think they're getting it from YouTube rather than watching it from.
And
they don't watch the analysis at all. No interest. Whereas we, half the time I tune in for the analysis rather than the match.
Yeah, they're getting their analysis, as you said, from social media. it's very, very different. Whereas obviously we would sit down and watch the actual commentary piece in the at halftime, but the kids are on, they're on YouTube. They watch everything on YouTube. Yeah. But listen, I just think from a teaching point of view, it's absolutely brilliant, and it's brilliant for them across the board on so many different levels. And look, hopefully at some point we'll see Ireland in a World Cup for them to really, really engage.
Maybe when it's 64 maybe teams. When,
maybe.
In our lads' school, sorry, John, in our lads' school, the teachers do little projects around the countries as well.
Yeah,
which is kind of a good way for them to learn about Curaçao, as I call them, or Curaçao, and the Bosnias and whatever.
Well, it's brilliant for cross-curricular.
It's
brilliant.
It's a great kind of platform for them to kind of learn about different places and different cultures.
Brings everything in, geography, maths, everything. It's brilliant.
I found when I was 7 or 11 at World Cups, when I got the Panini albums, it was a great education for me to learn players from different countries and learn about that. And then what I'm interested in now, not this World Cup, but say Denmark in 86 or Yugoslavia in 1990 and the players they had, and then, you know, who did they play for, which clubs? And even still, even today, when you're looking at players that are making, I suppose, their debut in the eyes of people who haven't seen them before at this World Cup, you're then going into, say, Transfermarkt, that kind of resource site, and you're going, well, who does that person play for? Because you need to do it for research purposes anyway. So Pau Cubarsí from Barcelona is 19 years of age. How many appearances did he make in La Liga last year? Or Yandy Amande, linked with Liverpool. Where is he playing at the moment? What's his assists? Johan Manzambi for Switzerland. So it's amazing that the Premier League makes everybody instantly known, but there are all these players at the World Cup now in 5-10 years time will be the Manes and the Firminos and the Salas of
absolutely
that are come through. Absolutely. And then sadly I know many Instagram followers the keeper from Cape Verde has now, like, it's like this guy they get fed at home. He had 100,000 Instagram followers, now he's 2.5 million after he's fair enough.
But
Jane, you're right, there's but it's great, and it's great. Look, it's as it kicks off from here, it's going to be a great summer of sport.
Let's go through then the supplements. We've got the Sunday Independent. I can hold up here. Pico, I'm relishing World Cup showdown with Messi. This is just a fairy tale. Pico Lopez in Cape Verde next Friday in Miami in the last 32 against Argentina. Kingdom come good. Kerry survive after thrilling battle with old rivals Tyrone and the Sunday Independent. Conor McKeown, Leinster in need of the O'Gara factor. We're going to talk about that in a while. The Sunday Times Sport. Kerry, David Clifford and Armin Heinrich there, who got that winning goal. Kerry edged Tyrone and All-Ireland thriller to take place in the last four. Down to the wire. Inside, bring on Messi, Cape Verde's World Cup mission. They seem happy. Eddie Jones, an English failure. Taking it up a level, Peter O'Reilly and the future of Ireland's victorious cricket teams. And David Walsh, the greatest summer of my sporting life. Bit of a nostalgia piece. The Irish Mail on Sunday, we have the back page, which says, Kingdom survive a scary tail end. O'Connor made to sweat as Kerry joined Mayo in the last four of the football championship. No Cape Fear, good headline, as Pico looks ahead to Messi clash and X-Factor Xabi set to move for Granit Xhaka to Chelsea. Back at the Sun as well, we have Pico Lopez with the Irish flag. Lopez, a World Cup knockout with Messi and co up next. Hero Pico still flying the flag. A lot more to come. Mayo's 23 points to 18 win over Cork, and pedal to metal, Kerry 225. Tyrone 27 points. I suppose one consequence of not us not being there is that we are being talking about Pico Lopez and that fairy tale for the Crumlin native.
Oh, it's just to think that next weekend we're saying, who would he be playing? Shamrock Rovers or whoever it is, and he'd be lining out against Messi. But I think I go back to the initial email that he just dismissed.
The LinkedIn.
And you think, imagine, he's probably thinking, if I ignored the second one or the second contact, it's incredible. And listen, the fact that Ireland aren't there, obviously, it's a huge clinger honour for a lot of people and a lot of us. And even for Crumlin, and we're talking about kids earlier, you know, for the whole community in Crumlin, I think it's just hopping up there. And for Rovers as well, and just for the guy himself and his family. I mean, his dad. Like, it's just a really, really lovely but incredible story. I mean, I doubt very much that out of the hundreds of players at that World Cup that you would find a more interesting story than that.
Yeah, I agree. Like, he's gone to like a place where he's, you know, you don't look at him and go, he could be sports star of the year kind of thing, you know. And first League of Ireland player to play in a knockout stage of a World Cup. But he comes across as an incredibly decent and humble person as well. And I think I was talking to a few people in Rovers about this during the week. He was a late-ish developer as well. And I think guys like that sometimes appreciate it more. Yeah. And he seems to be living in every minute of it. And his mum has also become an absolute rock star as well, which is brilliant. But layers to that story, obviously, you know, big for Crumlin, big for Rovers, big for Irish football, a fella with dual identity, when a better way of saying it, is that Irish flag shows. Yeah. And everyone's got behind him.
Yeah.
Peak Pico, though, I think, at the moment. It's...
Pico. But even going forward for his own career, and Nick, you'd obviously, you know more about this. I mean, this is going to open up doors for him. 100%. That this is it's actually life changing for him and his family.
And his age profile as well. Yeah. Whether he stays in football or he'll be involved in the outskirts of it anyway, because he's quite eloquent. He's a good talker. And his exchange with Bradley was just very, very funny, I thought. Where, I don't know if you saw it, John, where they're doing the social, the phone after
the FaceTime after the
match. I did test you too because you're passing the ball so well.
What about then the stories in the papers about the World Cup? So Messi, Maradona, there's a bit of lament in the Sunday Independent, Nadine, from Tommy Conlon.
Yeah.
Just, I suppose, accepting that for all the emotional attachment to Diego Maradona, that Lionel Messi is seen as the greatest of all time, really, and accepted.
Yeah, and I actually loved this piece, and I loved the way Tommy wrote it. You know, it's really evocative, and especially his tribute to Maradona, especially the way he was describing how Maradona played. I could find myself just visualising those clips that we see of him now. It was just a beautiful first section to it. And then he really gets into detail, I suppose, about the longevity of Messi. I mean, and what he's actually won. When you read it, and you go through everything. And even, you know, when you look at Messi now, you know, people would look at that, you know, move to America as kind of, you know, we took a step back. But you hear players who move from, say, the Premier League to America, okay, perhaps on the pitch, they're of a different standard. But the travel when you're playing as a professional in American sports is incredible. Like, you could be based, so he's based in Miami. He could be flying over to California a couple of times a year. You know that. Even the standard of the pitches, the Astro. So for him to still be going in that regard. And, you know, I think just with Argentina as well, themselves, the way, when you're comparing both players, Maradona had to carry that whole team. And nothing really at that time was built around him, because I suppose coaching and tactics at, when he was playing it, they weren't at the level they are now. Whereas this Argentinian team, everything is set up to allow Messi the space, the time to excel on the ball. So I always feel comparing them, it's not unfair, but it's very, very hard.
Yeah.
You know, but listen, Messi, like, he's just... He is just the. I feel now. I would have been Ronaldo maybe 10 years ago, but now I'm fully on board.
And they're both amazing, Ronaldo and in Messi. In different
ways. Absolutely.
Six World Cups is an incredible achievement. I think what's interesting to me is the and Tommy Conlon touched on this, and you can get it elsewhere as well. Is there was always a reluctance to really embrace Messi by Argentinian fans, and he famously fell out, obviously, where he got a lot of blame. And even though he was from a semi-working class background as well, as obviously Maradona came from the streets, he was kind of seen as kind of, he went to Barcelona 14, he wasn't really kind of one of them, he was always a bit distant and aloof. And I think there's an interesting piece here, John, he talks about, to understand Messi you must understand and acknowledge the shadow of Diego Maradona. So Messi's grown up in this comparative thing with Maradona, he's been in his shadow, and I think you don't have this Messi narrative without knowing the Maradona narrative as well. And I think this silent tension that he talks about between Messi and the Argentinian fans, it was kind of only put to bed really after the World Cup in Qatar. But, like, you know, you're going about who's the best. Look, it's impossible to make comparisons between one generation and the next. I grew up with Maradona, was my all-time greatest. But you look at Messi now in his sixth World Cup, scores a hat-trick to today. Like, if Argentina go on a run here, I think it kind of puts them in a completely different league again to even Maradona, which is a huge statement.
Yeah, there's a lovely, lovely sentence. Messi is the greatest, but Maradona will stay in my heart forever. And I think that will resonate with the majority of people reading that piece today.
Look, even overnight, he scored again. He's now on 6 goals, scored in the win over Jordan, came off the bench, put a free kick into the back of the net. 7 games now, successively in World Cups, he has scored a goal. And he's 39 years of age, so...
His only black mark is that first World Cup that he didn't score at.
Yeah, and I didn't think he was helped by his manager, Peckerman, who didn't give him the chance and didn't believe in him young enough. But then again, Maradona didn't play in 78 either, so... Yeah. Messi and Maradona, a lovely piece by Tommy Conlon in the Sunday Independent today. Erling Haaland as well, or Haaland. in the Sunday Independent. George Sims, I mean, this, I believe, was originally written in The Observer. But there was just really some lovely writing, lovely descriptive powers of the unique figure that is Erling Haaland, or Haaland.
Yeah, I really enjoy this as well. And like, Haaland is, he's one of these people that, is, I wouldn't say he's even love-hate. I think people don't really love him, right? It's one of these ones. And like, maybe there's a bit of the joylessness of Man City sometimes and he battering teams week after week. But he's, and the way he plays, he's not, as he describes here really eloquently, he could be out of the game for 70 minutes and end up with a hat-trick. Mm. And he is an absolutely unique individual, and he's not all power and pace. He's got a lot more going for him, and his ability to win games. And his record is, we're talking about Messi's record earlier, 59 goals in 52 games at international level. 16 goals in qualification is a record. Like, he is an absolute phenomenon. And I think as this tournament goes on, Norway are, you know, they rested their team the other night. They're a team I don't think anybody would fancy playing. They have a really good team, and he's up there with being the best striker in the world right now. He could score a bag full of goals, and you've got him and your team and Udegaard and others, you know, I wouldn't be backing against them, to be honest.
Just in the piece quote here, there's a reasonable argument Haaland is already the most famous Norwegian ever, usurping artist Edvard Munch and or Munch and playwright Henrik Ibsen, Norse god Thor and pop band Aha. Yeah. Journalist Erik Grasas Stevens called him Norway's most valuable commodity since oil, salmon, and the tripartite cooperation between trade unions, employers and government.
Yeah, very good. And I mean, when the, if you look back to the Real Madrid presidential election, Raquel May, who lost out to Florentino Perez, one of his election promises was that he would deliver Haaland to Real Madrid. He obviously lost the election, but it's no surprise that Haaland has been, I suppose, referenced in that regard. I think with him as well, you know, and the stat is here, only 11 players have more Premier League assists since he joined Man City. You never think of Erling Haaland as an assist, an assistant in a sense. You know, and he's described as being, you know, he has roboticism and he's always been a misconception. But the stats are there to prove it. I just think with him, obviously, as you said, Mick, in this World Cup, when you have somebody like Haaland in your team, you're always going to be in with a chance of going very far. I'm just interested with Haaland now, post-World Cup, post-Pep, what are Man City going to look like? I know they've started spending big, but I just don't see Haaland ending up staying in City. For the rest of his career, so I'm excited to see where he will end up. Would it be Madrid? Will he stay in the Premier League? You know,
I think it'd be lovely. It'd be great to see him go somewhere else. As a Man United fan, I'd say that obviously, but it's a really good piece, this one, and he talks about, you know, the criticism of Haaland about he doesn't produce these moments of extreme beauty. But then he hits on something that you touched on as well, Nadine, where him being unselfish, and he's happy to make runs and take 2-3 players out of the game. And he said he helped create 2 brilliant chances for Martin Odegaard. The first by distracting 3 defenders, the second with a deft leaping flick. And that's something in his game that people, I don't think, appreciate, that actually, even as a goal scorer, he's actually completely egoless and unselfish, as well as been incredibly brilliant at what he does. And his art is just sticking the ball in the back of the net. And I don't think there's anybody better in the world right now.
Another piece, last August he added his mother's surname, Braut, to his Norway shirt per Norwegian custom. He and his dad, who traditionally socialist Oslo, is set to appear to have turned on after he moved to Switzerland to avoid paying tax, spent £100,000 on the only surviving copy of Heims Kringla, a book of 16th century Viking sagas, and then donated it to his hometown's public library. He said if he weren't a footballer, he would work on a farm at home, still drinking raw milk every morning. He also has a Hermes handbag collection worth £650,000, a life of extremes.
I'd love a fraction of that handbag collection, let me tell you. That's very polarised.
I'd trust you, John, to pick that bit out, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's... I do find when I look at him in the... He's a kind of curiosity about life, which I enjoy for a footballer.
Yeah.
Whether it's sitting on planes for hours saying nothing, or walking around New York, or he seems to enjoy what he is, despite the pressures, despite the madness of football. He seems to be able to live outside the bubble a bit, which I enjoy.
Yeah, I'm always interested as well, like where sons of footballers, right, or sons of professional sports people, right, so they grow up in an environment where they're never settled. So he didn't grow up in, you know, a small town in Norway, went to primary school, went to second. He did, like, he was in Leeds, born in Leeds, right? I think,
yeah,
and then
yeah,
obviously moved around City and other clubs as well. So, you know, how do those kids, you know, grow up? They obviously had a privileged enough lifestyle, moving from place to place in a professional environment, and then he develops into this kind of wonder star himself. That kind of, I don't know, it'd be interesting to get his sense of
where's his base? Where's his identity? It's so transient.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably educated in a few different international schools.
And a bit at home, I'd imagine.
And a bit at home, maybe, yeah. It's an interest in life.
We're speaking to Mick O'Keefe and Nadine Doherty on the Sunday pay-per-view here on Off the Ball on News Talk. Are you Ireland in disguise, writes Mark Gallagher in the Irish Daily Mail. Agonising defeats, a tetchy manager, tortured debate. Scotland have turned into the boys in green. And that was written before Steve Clarke stepped down as Scotland manager with no prospect of reaching the knockout stage. They are going home, Scotland, and they've never reached a knockout stage of a World Cup, which is just a remarkable stat that continues to exist.
It's incredible. Like, and you look at the teams they had and the tournaments that they took part in. You go back to 78 and you go to other tournaments, 86. Like, they've had brilliant teams. This team they had, I think, was good enough to get out of the group.
Yeah.
I don't think they're any great shakes, right? No. We're a slightly better version of us in some respects. And then I would say, looking at them now, we probably have better long-term potential than them. But Mark Gallagher is he writes very well, as we know, but he's a couple of nice quips here about Scotland and that kind of comparing them to Ireland and taking it through the lens of some of the analysis work that's been done. So, you know, he has a bit here about Steve Clarke channeling his inner Martin O'Neill by giving the most curt and tetchy interview since RT Donoghue had the quiz the Derrymen about a 4-1 defeat to Wales. I don't think Clarke has covered himself in glory. And then, you know, you get this, and it's a bit of an Irish thing as well, but we don't do it as much as the Scots. But, you know, the Scots, you read this article every time they get beaten, right, where we don't produce technical players. The Scottish players of the past aren't being produced. There's a problem with the big two aren't taking a bigger view of Scotland. So, you know, similar to conversations we have in this country about Fleetair, GA and the death of any particular championship on black cards and red cards, and you can time your clock by Scotland overanalyzing the demise of their football team. And it's a pity, because I would have liked to see them get through to the next round, but they weren't good enough.
They weren't good enough to do it. The group, they technically on paper probably were, with three going through. But from the very first game, from that Haiti game, which I actually watched most of that, they were just poor. But they do, as you said, like, they do have technical players. Like, there's Scott McTominay has just excelled in that.
John McGinn,
this year.
Europa
John
League
McGinn.
Winner.
Yeah, you know,
Andy,
like,
Robertson, maybe past his best, but still a big name.
So, you know, did Clarke deserve the pylon that he got? Possibly. I think he got more of that pylon for the post match interview and so on. But should he have gotten more out of them?
Like,
possibly.
I think what the World Cup shows is that limited teams, you can get the sum of the parts can get you so far, and that gives you hope as an Irish fan, where actually if you're organised and committed and united, you can actually progress. Now, you won't win the World Cup, right, but you look at Cape Verde and you look at other countries that have, you know, Iran, you know, Canada, that are, you know, that have just been well organised, well set up, have a bit of a cause. Scotland just looked kind of poor and disorganised and never really looked like they were going to get through.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.